President Wilkinson, faculty members, and students from all over the world. And let me tell you how glad I am to come here. I always get something. I feel better when I go away. There's a very delightful spirit here. I might say a lovely spirit, advisedly. I'm sure there's sitting in this audience a brilliant and beautiful young woman from Salt Lake City. When we asked her why she came here, if she came here for social or academic purposes, she said with great candor, "I hope to succeed in both." I hope she does. I wonder if I might tell you for a minute my own story. It's a very simple and brief story. 70 years ago, September last, my mother, three brothers, and myself came to Provo in a covered wagon with provisions and bedding and clothing and with the family cow behind the wagon. We hired or rented a home, and on Saturday, four of us registered in the intermediate department of the academy. And on Monday morning, with our hair neatly combed, we went to the first devotional exercises. For the first time in my life, I heard a choir sing in school and heard a prayer offered. The faculty sat on a little platform. I think there were about seven of them, and they looked very learned to us and far away. Brother Mazur made a few announcements. We were off to a great start. That's a very primitive picture, my brothers and sisters, of the wagon and the family cow. But wrapped up in it somehow, there's something fundamentally wonderful. My father had never been to school. I think he said he attended school 3 weeks and the teacher was sick all the time. But somehow he knew the way to equate values and to give first things, first place. He thought we wouldn't eat any more in Provo than we would in Fillmore, and it'd be a good thing to come. And so, my brothers and sisters, I've been coming here off and on for 70 years. And you're looking and listening to the past tense. I know it'll gladden your heart a little when I say that so long as William Knight lives, I'm going to have a witness that on one occasion here I won a prize for being the handsomest man. And men were good looking in those days. Now for a minute. If I had time, I would like to talk to you about three things, but I haven't, but I must mention them now. This institution has justified the faith of its founders. Two, this institution has a great president. He didn't pay me, but I'd like to come down and say something about him. And three, I'm saying it to you with all candor, that never in the history of this institution, I honestly believe, Have there been finer young men and women than are sitting here in front of me today? And now, I didn't quite finish my first story. The faculty that we looked at that morning are all gone. My mother has gone, peace to her memory. And this winter morning, the grass is green over the resting place of all my brothers who registered here. Their lips are closed forever, but as a survivor, I must stand up and say, for my own brothers, that they stood well among the good men of their time. My father never did a wiser thing than to tie the family cow to the wagon and start us toward Provo. Now, President Wilkinson, I'm entitled to say something about Dr. Major. I knew him for 18 years. One can never look at this institution in retrospect without seeing the chaste and upright figure of Carl G. Major away off at the end. Under Brigham Young, he was the founder of this institution. He shaped its destiny and developed the atmosphere in which it has prospered. When he came here 78 years ago, no academic procession preceded his installation as the head of this institution. I doubt if any of the people of this quiet little city 78 years ago was aware of his coming. If they were, they were in no manner concerned. And let me say in the next breath that in the annals of this city, no event has affected it so beneficially as the founding of this institution by Carl G. Major. It has brought millions of dollars to this city and thousands of the finest young people in the world and made Provo the educational center of the church, and the church is worldwide. That's what it did for Provo. Well, who was Carl G. Major? He was a German schoolteacher and a Mormon convert. And more than that, he was an educated man with a settled and militant faith in the gospel of Jesus Christ. A man with a brilliant mind and a lofty and luminous soul. And running through the rigor of his discipline was a golden thread of humor. Brother Major, that's what we called him. Brother Major was an actor, an orator, a master craftsman in the great art of teaching. And above all, he was a technician in character building. This was one of his mottos. I shall never forget it. I've heard him preach on it more than once. There is a Mount Sinai for every child of God if he will only climb it. And he made climbers. Somehow he had the divine faculty of leading students up into the spiritual altitudes where they could see life in a fine perspective. Yes. Well, what did he bring here? I think I must read. that if I can. Well, I do not find my glasses, but I'll read it anyhow. Luck can't beat me. What did he bring here? The students in his day heard many times the dramatic rehearsal of his visit to Brigham Young before coming to Provo. He was a German scholar, indoctrinated, traditionated, and regimented in the law of obedience. So he went confidently to President Brigham Young to receive his plans and specifications, which he hoped to put into operation here. I've heard your president refer to this, and well might any president. Brother Major said to Brigham Young, "I am ready to go to Provo. Now, what are your instructions?" "Only this," replied Brigham Young. "We want you to remember that you should not teach even the alphabet or the multiplication tables without the Spirit of God. That's all. God bless you. Goodbye." He used to walk up and down the platform. Then he went out onto South Temple and walked down the street and said to himself, "What does President Young mean? Does he expect me to go to Provo and teach the alphabet and the multiplication tables?" And then he said, the light dawned upon him. He said, that's only a key. And so he came down here, and in the beginning he played the organ and led the choir and planned the courses and taught the classes. In it all, he was guided by that key. Now, for a minute, this is what I want to read. This is only my interpretation, my brothers and sisters. Let us examine for a moment the mandate given by the founder of the institution to Brother Major. What did it mean? It meant that this institution was built upon the fundamental truth that God lives and reveals his will to his children, that revelation is a modern reality, that there never need be any speculation about the actual existence of God or the mission of the Redeemer of the world. The church itself stands and rests firmly upon that foundation. It offers no compromise to those who scoff at visions, revelations, or the possibility of messengers sent from the presence of God. The major responsibility of this university is to teach that truth to the children of this church. And I'm going to say now here, never in its history, I honestly believe, has it realized that objective more perfectly than it has today. All right, now I come for a few minutes to my message here. Still, I can't find my glasses. Since that April morning in 1876, when Carl G. Major stood before the first student body, 29 in all, many changes have taken place. A long procession of men and women have passed through the portals of this institution to the great world of affairs. The vast majority of these have taken with them an intangible something which has affected forever their lives. In that day, young men came here from the various walks of life, many of them from the sheep camp, the cattle ranch, the farm, the mine, the mines or the mills, and they stayed only the winter, But when they went home in the spring to do the plowing, there was a new light shining in their eyes, a new force warming their hearts. It is a far cry from that day to this. The school has moved majestically forward. Now young men and women come here from all parts of the world. And today, this is a great national, if not international, student body. A really great school. President Wilkinson, I'm told that this is the largest denominational school in the United States. The school was great in its poverty and infancy. The achievement of its early students confirmed this statement. Think of it. I knew personally Reed Smoot, one of the original 29, 30 years in the United States Senate, an apostle of the Lord Jesus Christ, a man of great force of character. William H. King of the class of 1880, 4 years in the lower house and 24 years in the Senate of the United States. Justice George Sutherland of the Supreme Court of the United States, a graduate of 1881. Dr. James E. Talmage, a scientist, writer, and an apostle. Dr. J. M. Tanner, lawyer and educator. N. L. Nelson, writer and philosopher. George H. Brimhall, renowned teacher and president, third president of the institution. Benjamin Clough, second president. Samuel R. Thurman, A. C. Nelson, J. T. Whirlton, George W. Middleton, and a long list of brilliant men. In my day, the school was having a struggle financially, but the days of its poverty and distress seem to have gone. Those were hard times. The people were poor and the students were poor. Think of it, $15 a month was a rather liberal allowance for board, schooling, and incidentals. And many of them got through on far less. Some of the poorest in purse were among the most successful ones. The man who became second president of this institution and who made a real contribution to its development walked 60 miles and carried all of his belongings upon his back. He slept under the stage in the old Lewis building and swept the floors for enough to eat. One of the most popular and universally beloved men that was ever graduated by this institution, a man who served 14 years as state superintendent of public instruction, told this dramatic story, and I heard it here. Listen to this. I had saved a little money to come to the academy. However, at the close of the term, I found myself without funds sufficient to stay and finish. So I wrote a letter to my father asking for assistance and received no reply. So I wrote a second letter and waited long for a reply, but none came. I wrote the third letter and was without necessary means to get home if it did not come. With hope diminishing, I made a daily trip to the post office. Finally, a letter was there with the money and the word why it had not reached me. This was the word. There was no post office where we lived. The nearest post office was in Salina, 4 miles away. And to reach Salina, my father was obliged to cross the Sevier River. It was springtime, and the river was very high. It overflowed its banks for a mile on each side. The bridge was entirely submerged except one rail. With the money, 3 gold pieces tied securely in a little sack to his left hand, my father waded out into the current. When the water became too deep to wade, he swam to the bridge, and the flood was nearly to his shoulders. He walked across the bridge, holding his left hand high, high above his head, and clinging to the rail with his other hand. With the aid of a rope on the other side, he swam to shore. At the post office in Salina, he mailed a letter with the money that I might finish my work in the school. I remember a young man standing up in assembly one day long ago, saying that his father had written to him, telling him that he sold his last cow and was sending him the money so he could finish. This boy said, no one knows what that sacrifice means. I have three brothers at home, and the Lord being my helper, I will never cease struggling until each of them, in his turn, can come and get what I have got here. And he made his word good. Two boys came here from Lehigh. They slept in a barn. They hired their bread baked, and that was about all they lived on. One of them became internationally known for his leadership of boys. The other became distinguished as an administrator, educator, and the author of textbooks. And I must not forget the little fellow from Dixie who slept in Brother Mazur's office in the old warehouse and who kept the stove fires going during the night and swept the floor that he might find his way through. He became recognized as a student of the Book of Mormon, taught it for many years, gave hundreds, if not thousands, of lectures on it, and had it in memory, I'm thinking, better than any other living man ever had it. And so I might continue. But I'm not here this morning to preach the virtues of poverty. I am here as the advocate and champion of the fellow who's obliged to struggle. With a contrite heart and with all the fervor at my command, I would like to preach the gospel of hope to every young man who is confronted with difficulties, whose circumstances are hard, and compel him to struggle. For struggle is the key which not only unlocks the storehouse of knowledge, but plants a man's feet firmly in the path that leads to great achievement. There is no other way to reach the heights where the victorious assemble. Carlyle declared labor is worship, and he preached the gospel of work with matchless eloquence. Spurgeon said on one occasion, "The Lord gets his best soldiers from the highlands of affliction." There is an urge deep as life itself in each of us to use the powers and to develop the gifts which are ours. The most lasting joy that comes to mortal man comes from the satisfaction of that urge. This is an unfinished world in which we have been sent to bear a part in its completion. When a man feels that every bit of good work is cooperation with the Almighty in building a great universe, he welcomes work. Let me say to the men here who struggle, who are willing to fight to the last rampart, who are forced to overcome difficulties, that tomorrow the world will be turned over to you. You and men like you will write the laws, preach the sermons, own the farms, manage the railroads, and run the government. Let us remember the role of the nobility of the earth lists not a single idler. Think of it when a young man has a desire to work. the capacity to work. And his efforts are directed by a deep religious conviction. He is off to a really great start. The far-seeing and thoughtful of mankind admonish us that the peace of the world, the happiness and the well-being of people, rests upon that ancient but secure foundation of faith in God. All through the years, this institution has been a conservator of that faith. It has a great heritage coming down from the beginning. If it preserves and cherishes that heritage, it will grow and prosper, rise and shine to recognition and honor among the great institutions of the world. Thank you.